But I do want to start, I know I asked you a homework assignment, but I actually do want to start with the good, the plus of the Celtics. And I want to start by asking you, you mentioned rotation last week, and it seems to me that they, Ime Udoka has put together, it looks to me like an eight-man rotation that's been very successful, particularly on defense. And the three guys coming off the bench, Josh Richardson, Dennis Schroeder, and Grant Williams, seem to be part of that steadying influence. Am I looking at it okay?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, those three, when you can count on eight guys giving you a consistent contribution, then I think he can keep going back to those guys. You mentioned Richardson. Grant Williams, who has been surprisingly good this year as a three-point shooter. I mean, he's, you know, shooting 42% on threes. And you wouldn't have thought that was going to happen. You might remember, Rick and Tim, that he began his career by missing his first 25 three-pointers as a rookie. First 25. And no one ever really believed he'd develop into a three-point shooter, but he is the best three-point shooter the Celtics have.
Wow.
Percentage-wise, for a rotation guy. I'm not talking for a guy who's only played a few minutes here or there.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, Rick. Eight guys sounds about right. You kind of wish it would be nine with Peyton Pritchard, who gets occasional playing time, and then two guys who are lost in the mix and not getting a chance to develop are, you know, Romeo Langford and Aaron Nesmith. They've been extremely disappointing. Maybe, I don't know if they're disappointing because they don't get playing time, or they're disappointing because if he did put them in, they wouldn't produce. It's hard to see. But for now, Rick, your point is well taken. They have an eight-man rotation, and you mentioned defense in particular. Their defensive rating has gone way up in the last 10 or 11 games. So, and, you know, part of that, we have to acknowledge, right, Tim and Rick, that they have not played the best teams.
Right.
You know, they beat the Orlando Magic, and they beat, the Pelicans and all that. They'll get a true test later this week when the Utah Jazz, who are one of the best teams in basketball, one of the better teams in the Western Conference, the Utah Jazz come to the Garden on Friday night. And isn't it interesting, too, regarding the improvement, Rick, that the Celtics are now virtually tied with the Brooklyn Nets, basically for the sixth and seventh spots in the Eastern Conference. And the Nets have come way downhill, and it should be noted, and we'll mention the ex-Celtic here, Kyrie Irving, that since Kyrie Irving joined the playing ranks for the Nets, and he only plays on the road because, I mean, he's blessed enough where he doesn't have to get a vaccination, you know. They're 2-7. The Nets are 2-7 with Kyrie Irving in the lineup.
Interesting. Hey, Tim and Mike, what do you guys think about the influence of Rob Williams III? What his impact?
To me, I don't know about you, Tim. I think he's probably the most, especially with Horford, you know, obviously showing his age at times. He's only shooting 29% on threes. Robert Williams has stepped up to play the big minutes that we hope he'd be able to play, because obviously prior to this season he showed an inclination of getting banged up a lot, missing three or four games at a time, missing 10 games here, 10 games there. He's been showing up a lot more often this year and playing much bigger minutes. And I'm amazed by his athleticism. I mean, he takes those lob passes, some of which look impossible to dunk, and he's got the long arms, and he redirects those lobs into easy dunks. And defensively, he's definitely one of the better shot blockers. I've watched every team in the NBA, and Robert Williams is definitely a premier shot blocker. You know, he's not as good as Rudy Gobert, who was with Utah and a taller player, and a couple other guys, but certainly Robert Williams ranks as an intimidating figure in the paint. And we see that. Sometimes guys, opposing players drive into the paint and they back off because Robert Williams is very quick on his feet and will block their shot if they try to convert a short jumper or go for the layup. Robert Williams has that kind of athleticism and agility to come on over and help defense and block shots. So yeah, I think Robert Williams is probably one of the most improved players in the league.
Oh, you waiting on me, Rick? All right, Mike, I want to go back for a second to something that you said. Rick,
yes.
Rick sort of added up about the improved level of the Celtics play and mentioning that they would have gone to basically an eight-man rotation. Didn't we say that exact thing? Was it last week?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, they need to find a set starting
right.
Five and two, three guys off the bench and everybody else sit there and watch until we're leading by 100 points.
Right. You're exactly right, Tim. And I think it's been a more settled rotation, though, in the past couple of weeks, whereas prior to this, the rookie coach Udoka was kind of trying different combinations, and it was inconsistent playing time for Schroeder, who sometimes was starting, sometimes he wasn't starting. Grant Williams, you know, like I said, heading into the season, hadn't shown much in terms of being a long-term answer off the bench, and he's certainly shown that ability this year. And so now they have, like I said, 8 solid guys, and I kind of wish Peyton Pritchard would play a bit more. But that's okay. Peyton Pritchard has shown, has his moments where he's really been good. And he has to be selective in using Peyton Pritchard anyway because of his lack of size. But certainly Peyton Pritchard is a terrific outside shooter who can stretch the floor with a three-pointer. So if you use him in the right situations in every game and not every third game, I think it could become like a 9-man rotation, you know? And guys, I'll tell you what, Tim, what do you think of this? Now, it was kind of foregone conclusion, Rick and Tim, that, you know, Jason Tatum would make the All-Star team. And he did, and he's averaging like 25 points a game. But Jaylen Brown, who did not make it, actually has better shooting numbers from the floor and from the three-point area. He has better numbers than Jason Tatum. So I kind of don't get that. I mean, obviously Tatum is much more of a glorified player on a national level. But in terms of real numbers, Jaylen Brown has had a better season.
You know, and it's just for the reason that you said, Mike, you know, the bigger press goes to Tatum. It seems over the past couple of years, the guy who gets slammed out of that duo, is the guy who has the better numbers. But we tend to look for the flaws in his game. You know, and he plays more subdued than his compatriot. You know, right. So he has a big game, you're like, wow, he did that? As opposed to, you know, when Tatum has, you know, that's to be expected. But, you know, Brown doesn't, you go like, geez. Because he's quieter.
He is.
He's not taking the big three. No, he's slashing to the hoop.
Yeah. You're right. He is a quieter, and obviously the NBA likes the flashy players who are also vocal and talkative and all that. Not that Jason Tatum is, like, flamboyant, but obviously he's got more of a national profile than Jaylen Brown. I think, obviously, even when they promote, let's say, a national TV game, Celtics versus Lakers or the Miami Heat or whatever, and they'll say, or the Philadelphia 76ers, for example, ESPN will promote it as a battle. And I hate this. Instead of promoting team versus team, they'll promote it as Joel Embiid versus Jason Tatum. Well, I mean, anybody that knows, they're not playing against each other. They're playing 5-on-5, you know? So let's call it Celtics versus 76ers and not Jason Tatum versus Joel Embiid. So Tatum I don't think Tatum has necessarily gone out of his way to establish a national reputation, but because he was so young and tasted successful early in his career, he's developed a national profile more so than Jaylen Brown, whose numbers overall throughout his career have been equal to or better than Jason Tatum's. So Rick, I don't know, you like both guys, so what do you think of that?
Well, I agree with both you guys, and the way Tim described both of them, I think is spot on, because I've been watching a lot lately, and I'm watching Wire to Wire, and I really like Jaylen Brown's game. I thought Tatum was a superior athlete. Now I'm not so sure, because I think Brown plays a smarter game. I've said that before, but one thing I am impressed with, although it drives me nuts when Tatum keeps making these stupid, unforced errors, is they seem to be fewer and fewer.
Right. I mean, I think Jason Tatum has made a concerted effort, Rick. He was getting criticized, as we all know, early in the season for taking too many threes and being in more of an isolation player than anybody else on the team and owning the basketball literally for 18 or 20 seconds out of the 24-second clock. And I think he's made a conscious effort to do less of that and to pass the ball early within the 24 seconds that the Celtics have the ball, passing the ball early, maybe getting it back and then taking a three. Or he's been taking it to the basket much more often.
Yeah.
In the last, 15 or 20 games, and I think he got a little fed up with the losing and taking the heat as the face of the franchise, so to speak, and he's gotten sick of the losing. So he's made a really good effort to take it to the basket more, to involve his teammates more, his assists are up, and what's the bottom line? They're winning more. They're
right.
winning more, and now they look like a team that could, you know, not only make the playoffs, but cause some problems in the first round of the playoffs.
Mike, I'm going to bypass you and ask Tim, because I don't want his feelings to be hurt, but what's Marcus Smart's contribution in all of this, Tim?
Doing what Mike and I have talked about in the past.
Yeah.
He's playing the setup man. He's cut down the number of crazy shots, and I think that's contributed to this sort of maturing, Mike, of the
yes.
offense. Where they're playing with more sense and sensibility, they're going to the hoop more. They're playing, well, he's always played solid defense, but he's getting the rest of them to buy into this, let's play the good defense, let's play the offense off of the defense. If we don't have it, let's set it up, let's work it around, let's work it in. You know, let's get it into Williams and let him get some time. Let him draw the defense back in. You can move in a little bit closer. You don't need a three, take a two. You know?
Yeah, he's taking fewer, Rick and Tim, he's taking fewer of those ill-advised threes late in the game. When it's a close game and he might have an open three, and early in the season he was just launching threes late in the game, and it was really costing the Celtics some possible victories. And now he's more judicious in his use of the three-point shot, because obviously statistically he's not a good three-point shooter, and I think he's realizing that now, and when he's wide open for a three, in the middle of the game or early in the game, he'll take it and see if he can get into a rhythm and a groove, and that's fine, because if he hits three or four of them, then you maybe trust him more in the third and fourth quarter to take those threes. But if he's not hitting the threes early in the game, in the middle of the game, he'll shy away from it in the fourth quarter, which is kind of what you want, because you want your better shooters with the ball in the final 6, 7, or 8 minutes of the game if the game is close.
All right, Mike, I asked Gary Larrabee about interviews and how things have changed over the years. Do you have an interview that you want to recap for us or bring up to the fore?
Well, I think last week, Rick, you mentioned maybe the homework assignment being, we talked, of course, I know about Julius Erving a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you mentioned maybe my homework. I feel like I'm back in college, by the way, when you give me these assignments.
Okay.
It's kind of great.
Okay.
But anyway, about possibly a person who, like you mentioned John Ahern a couple of times, and I remember him very well. It's sort of like sort of like giving you some confidence and taking you under his wing when you were a young reporter.
Yep, yep.
Well, the guy, as soon as you gave me this homework assignment a week ago, the guy I thought of immediately was actually a baseball owner. Bill Veeck.
Oh, you mentioned
remember
that. Bill Veeck, really? Yeah.
Bill Veeck, as in Wreck.
Yeah.
That was his nickname. And, of course, he owned a bunch of different teams, including the Cleveland Indians. And he signed Larry Doby, the first
mm-hmm.
black player in the American League. And I think he actually signed him, although he didn't make it as early to the majors as Jackie Robinson did. I mean, obviously, that was a phenomenal breakthrough, signing a black player back in the 1940s, and Bill Veeck was that guy. Well, the story that I want to mention locally for me as a young reporter was that Bill Veeck, when I was still at Northeastern and kind of interning at the old Beverly Times, which you may remember, Rick and Tim, Bill Veeck came to Peabody, made a personal appearance. At the time, he was the owner of the Chicago White Sox. So the Sports Center at the time sends me out there, and I go, he's going to be at Peabody High, go talk to Bill Veeck, write any kind of story you want. I said, okay. So I get there, and I'm about to go into the building. It was a cold winter night, and I'm thinking, I'm going to talk to the owner of a major league team. What do I talk about? I mean, you know, I'm just some 19, 20-year-old kid. And what do we do here, right? I'm sure, Dick, Rick, you might have felt that same intimidation
early
on when you were going to maybe interview someone who was of national importance, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I get into Peabody High, and I had a one-on-one with Bill Veeck. And, you know, he could sense that I was a little nervous, and he just sat me down, and he was so cool, and his demeanor was so calm,
mm-hmm.
and he could sense that I was nervous. He started asking me for my background. Where do you go to school?
Yeah.
what sports do you like the best? And he put me at ease in terms of interviewing him. And after that, it was a breeze, because I felt like I was almost like in a 30-minute period, or however long I was there, making a new friend,
yeah,
you know?
Wow.
And he put me at ease in terms of interviewing him. And, of course, he had a rich background at this point around 1970. Like I said, he had owned the Cleveland Indians.
Oh, he was larger than life. Are you kidding me?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And how about this? He signed Eddie Goodell. Remember that? A 3'7" guy?
Yes, yes.
And it was
a one plate appearance.
However,
yep.
Goodell took four, he was like 3'7" and
yep.
he wore the number 1/8.
Yep.
Like 1/8. You know? Not number 18, but 1/8. The fraction. And it was a joke, obviously, but he wanted to prove that he could send the guy up. They took four pitches and walked, and then he had him as a pinch, he pinch ran for him.
Mm-hmm.
But he did all kinds of fun stuff in baseball that you could get away with back in the 50s and 60s and all that. For example, he had the exploding scoreboard at Comiskey Park in Chicago, and he once, when he owned the Milwaukee Brewers, Rick, and not when the Brewers were a major league team, but when they were a triple A team,
mm-hmm.
he would give away animals during the game, live animals to fans during the game.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would have morning games for people who worked the overnight shift who might want to go see a major league game. So he would have games at 9 or 10 in the morning for people who worked the graveyard shift in Milwaukee. So he did all kinds of fun stuff that challenged the establishment, but it wasn't destructive. It was fun stuff that he kind of trying to break through and make it much more fun for the fans. But for me, on a personal level, he put me at ease when I was just a 20-year-old kid at Northeastern University, and it went so smoothly, and I came back with a good story, and I felt good about what I was doing because he made me feel that as a young guy, I could long term that I might be able to do the job that a newspaper was looking for.
Hey, Mike.
Yes.
I also put the White Sox in shorts.
Right, exactly. He brought the Cleveland Indians to their first World Series in a long time, and of course the White Sox as well. And but he was just I think a great person. He had some health problems later in life and all that. However, I just remember him as a great person for a young guy to meet. And as my first interview with a major league owner, it couldn't have been more relaxed.
I got to tell you that thank you for that, because my impression of Bill Veeck, reading about him in Sports Illustrated and Sport Magazine and all that, was that he was a bit of a nutcase and not even close. I mean, I really appreciate your telling me this. And Mike, what did that do for your? Obviously, it did something for your confidence, because you're talking about this X number of years later.
Right, exactly. And you know what? Part two of this, Rick, because you had me thinking after you posed that question to me last week, and again, you mentioned Ahern, and along the same lines, when I was at Northeastern University in the middle of a semester at school, I had an assignment to do some kind of major project for class, and I decided on my own to go to the Boston Globe office. So this is kind of going to be a little bit in line with your Ahern story. I went to the Boston Globe office to see how a major metropolitan newspaper operates its sports section.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to view, I guess I must have been kind of aggressive in being able to do this, because I asked to interview Jerry Nason, who was the sports editor at the time,
yep,
and who had a long and storied career covering the Boston Marathon in particular. I interviewed Jerry Nason, who was kind of an older gentleman at the time, a very serious guy. At the same time, I interviewed Bud Collins,
wow.
who was a national tennis writer,
yep.
was international tennis writer, who was just the opposite of Nason, very laid back, great sense of humor. He sat me down, and in the process of interviewing him, he would say, Mike, if you're going to get in this business, you have to have a sense of humor. You have to be able to engage athletes and bring out, show your sense of humor and have them be in a relaxed frame when you interview them. You have to do these things if you're going to become a sports writer.
Wow.
And, he gave me some other perspectives that I hadn't thought about at the time, and I was just a college sophomore, junior at the time. So, again, similar to your story with Ahern, I went directly into the Boston Globe offices on Morrissey
wow.
Boulevard and with a tape recorder and interviewed three or four guys on their sports staff, and I had set that up in advance. And they were kind and generous with their time and talking about their backgrounds and talking about how does a big city newspaper operate on a daily basis. And I wrote a very long, it was like a project, and I can remember getting an A on it.
Oh, well, yeah. Hello. Yeah. Oh, my God. Did you get a picture of him in his wild clothes?
Oh my God. Bud Collins?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God. He wore the S. Of course, he was certainly outrageously dressed. would make an impression in Melbourne, Australia, as well
oh my
as
God.
Massachusetts with the way he dressed. And, a few years later, Rick, to bring this up to 1983, my wife Eileen and I were in London for the first time. And Wimbledon happened to be, the tournament happened to be on at the same time. So I get there. I didn't have a press pass. I was on vacation. So we get to Wimbledon. I remember buying the tickets. They were the equivalent of $4 to get into Wimbledon. And it was a June day. And it was a gorgeous day. And in looking at the program that particular day, I noticed that Heather Crowe of Topsfield was in the field playing in Wimbledon. She went to Masconomet Regional. She had gotten a full scholarship to Indiana University, and now she was turned pro. And I had no idea that she wasn't a featured player, but she was playing on one of the side courts. And I said to my wife, Eileen, I gotta go see Heather Crowe play. So, I remember having napkins or a couple of pieces of paper. I went to the court where Heather Crowe was playing, and I said, this is a story for us, for the Salem News.
Uh-huh.
So out of the clear blue, I'm following her match, and I'm taking notes, and then I go courtside afterwards. There was no one interrupting. I said, Heather, how you doing? She recognized me right away. And Bud Collins was on that same side court, and he says, Mike Grenier, what are you doing here?
All right.
Oh, he says, this girl. He says, you know this girl. She's local for you.
Oh.
And sure enough, he was kidding me about it, and then I followed that up by calling Bill Kaporis, the sports editor, collect from London, England, Wimbledon, and dictated a story off the top of my head that was used in the Salem News the next day. So, Bud Collins, I have nothing but fond memories of maybe
that's fantastic.
Him hearing me the right way, and also a few years later, you know, saying, hey, Mike, how you doing? I see you've sort of made it in the business,
man.
You know?
Yep. Tim, finish up.
I can't stop that.
Nobody can. Are you kidding me?
Well, that's fun. It's fun to this. When you give me, it kind of perks up my memory, Rick, when you give me this homework.
We got to do this because.
But you know what, Mike? As a former history teacher and you know, history aficionado, not aficionado, but, you know, I love when we go retro. You know that. How many times have we spent too long in Rick's eyes going retro?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, the thing is, and I've told this one before. We're way overdue here, but I've told this one before. Bill Newell and I. And Tim, you know this one. We were at an item sports banquet in December one time, and it was at the old porthole, I think it was. And we got there early. There was a bar. It was not serving alcoholic beverages for the kid that night. The kids. We got there, and Johnny Pesky was there. We went over to walk over to him because Bill knew him. And Pesky said to Bill, he says, oh, I listen to you guys on Saturdays all the time. And he said, Rick, I know you. I listen to you. Johnny Pesky, right?
Unbelievable.
So then, but then the next year, same situation. We walk in early and Johnny Pesky is there at the bar having a soft drink. And he looks at me and he says, hi, Rick, how you doing? And I almost passed out. I mean,
yep.
He met me once. Like, are you kidding me?
Tremendous person.
Oh, it was awesome.
Pesky was one of the great human beings. One of the most down-to-earth, genuine people, right, Rick? I think we
agree
on that. And Tim would too. And, of course, his best buddy was Bobby Doerr, who was the same way. I mean, you know, a Hall of Fame-type resume. One of the nicest people came from Oregon, as I believe, and he and Pesky were fast friends during their Red Sox era. And, of course, Pesky was also a very good friend of Ted Williams.
Well, I think Tim has some Honus Wagner stories, don't you, Tim?
Thank you, Rick. Rick,
I could add one quick local note.
No, let Tim do it first, Mike, then we'll finish up.
Go ahead, Tim.
You know, Rick, I told you, I never want to, you know, expose how far back.
except who's the oldest guy in the room right here? I'm sitting here in Gloucester, so, you know. Tim, you've got some stories, though. You've met some pros, and you've played with pros, for God's sakes.
Yeah, I met McGill Stairs, had my picture taken with him, got his autograph. Oh, my God, talk about a class individual. Oh, my word.
I'm sorry, Tim. Who was that, Tim?
McGill Stairs.
Oh, yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'll tell you, like, you know, last week I mentioned had a chance to talk to Caldwell Jones after a Boston Celtics.
Yes.
You know, and again, just engaging, you know, and no big deal. But it's all how you, Mikey, it's all how you approach them.
Yes, no doubt about it.
If they're being a jerk, they're going to just swat you away. But if you go up there and you're polite, you know, it's unbelievable. I went to a party, my next door neighbor had a party, John Blum, when he played with the Bruins.
Yes.
And he had a holiday party at his house, and this is what Mike Milbury was young. Gordon Kluzak was on crutches because he had knee surgery. Lyndon Byers was doing what he did best. We all know what that was.
Yeah.
And there were, there had to be seven or eight of them, you know, that were there. And you've got to have it. We're talking away. One night when I used to work the door up at the balcony lounge, the Bruins all came in for after a preseason game.
Yeah.
And they all hung at the side of the bar, and I told somebody, here, collect the money. And I went over, and I spent the rest of the evening talking to Dick Redman and a bunch of the other guys for the rest of the night.
That's great stuff, Tim. Yeah, that's great stuff. It is all about the way you approach them, like you said, because they can swat you away. But, you know, you can sense when the guy gets comfortable with you when you get to meet him, and you can sense if their time is valuable to them and they need to move on, and you just back off politely. But if they're willing to engage with you, then why not go for it?
Well, you got to do your homework with these guys.
I grew up playing baseball with John Tudor. And first at Trinity Hills Baseball Clinic in Lynn.
Yep.
And Dave, his catcher at Peabody. Why am I missing? Dave Betancourt.
Yes.
I was there every Sunday. I met some legendary players from the North Shore at Trinity Hills Clinic. Tommy Pinto from Salem.
Yep.
What a player he was. But I was in the porthole one night, the old porthole on the corner of Washington and the Linway.
Yep.
And Tudor comes in, and who's he with? Mike Torres of the Red Sox.
Wow. Huh?
Mm-hmm. You look at Torres on the field on TV, and okay, he's a good-sized guy. My God, I couldn't believe how wide this guy was. He's like 6'4", and he had to be 5 feet wide.
Yeah.
And we just stood there, and, I'm talking with him, I'm talking to Torres, and I'm like, I'm just hanging. I never didn't buy a beer the entire night. We're just chatting away. Oh, it was great.
Yeah.
All right, Mike. Listen, you had one more thing you wanted to say locally.
Well, no. I love the retro stuff. But I'll just say what's happening on a contemporary level. Our local connection, Pat Connaughton, hit 6 threes last night.
Oh, okay.
Including 4 in a row in the third quarter, scores 18 points, and they win. And now the Bucks are a half game out of first place in the Eastern Conference. Yeah. I texted him last night, and I said, the most important thing, Pat, is that you guys are just a half a game out. And he said, exactly.
Oh, wow.
It doesn't matter how many. You know, they're just a half game behind the Chicago Bulls. The Miami Heat for first place in the Eastern Conference.
All right, you got to keep us up to date with that because that's a great local story. I'm going to let you pick your own homework assignment for next week, but I hope it involves an interview of some sort.
Well, John Tudor, Tim just brought up a great name from the North Shore, a really underrated pitcher. We could talk about him because I covered much of his career.
Let's do it. All right, Mike, as I told Gary and Tim, we'll be back next week. Going to take the following week off.
That sounds great, guys. I appreciate your time and effort here. It's great talking retro.
Oh, it is. It's wonderful. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye now.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Yep.
Oh, bye, man.
Bye, Mike. Good night.